Chapter 3 After I drop Sarah off at her house, I switch into detective mode. It's only been a little while since the whole aliens are real and attacking your school thing, but since then I've been trying to get as much information about what's going on as possible. I'd like to say that it's so that if Earth has to fight, I can take on the bad guys, but I think it's mostly just because I need something to do. And because I like to be a person in the know. Preferably the one calling the shots. Maybe that's what made me such a good quarterback. It's surprisingly tough to go from being the guy who knows everything that's going on in school to some dumb jock who didn't even realize there was a war going on around him. I can fix that. I just have to gather info. Plus, it gives me something to talk to Sarah about other than whether or not I think John, and the others, but mostly just John, is okay or not. Even if it does make me sound a little like Nutso Sam. I take the long way home and drive past the high school. Not that I can get anywhere close to it, the authorities have the whole area around it pretty locked down. It isn't the police who are running the show now. If so, I could probably camp out on the school lawn if I wanted to, since my dad is the sheriff. No, there are people much higher up running the investigation. The FBI, and I'm guessing some other three-letter government groups that we civilians aren't even supposed to know about. There are a lot of people in black suits walking around paradise these days, which I guess makes sense, since this is some grade-A Area 51 shit. Once I'd tried to sneak over to the school through the woods that border it, but they've got all the surrounding areas lit up with giant floodlights at night. I couldn't get within a few yards of the edge of the trees, or else someone might have seen me. It would have been a nice time to have that alien girl, Six, and her invisibility powers around. Today, I recognize the cop who's posted to make sure that no one turns down the street that leads to the school. Todd is only 3 or 4 years older than me. He was a big town football star back in the day, and always likes to corner me and talk stats and plays when I'm at the station. I hesitate for a second, and then decide to try my luck. I want to know what's going on at the school. Maybe if I can get close enough to see what kind of detective work they're doing, I can get an idea of how much they do or don't know. Maybe I can even talk one of them into spilling a few secrets if I don't see any pale dudes walking around. I make a loop and come back to the school. As I'm doing so, I take off my letter jacket and toss it into the back seat, shoving my backpack on top of it. "Hey, man," I say, pulling up beside Todd. A couple of traffic barrels sit in front of my bumper. "How's it going?" "Just freezing my ass off to protect this sacred ground," he says, shoving his hands into his pockets and nodding his head towards the school. I can't tell if he's joking about the sacred ground or not, because he's definitely the kind of guy who will be talking about his high school glory days until his dying breath. "Yeah," I say, trying my best to sound casual. "What are they doing over there, anyway? I mean, I heard the place is a mess, but Dad says they aren't telling you much about whether they're finding anything useful or not." "It's all classified intel," Todd says, raising his eyebrows just a little bit to make it sound really important. "You know, homeland security type stuff. Apparently the government doesn't like it too much if you try to destroy a school."
"I bet, man," I nod.
"Hey, so I actually left my letter jacket in the locker room before all this shit went down, and I know this is stupid, but I feel kind of naked without it. Do you think I could just run in really fast and grab it? I mean, you probably felt the same way about yours when you were racking up touchdowns, right? It's like a second skin." Something weird happens to Todd's face. He's quiet, and it looks like he just got a big whiff of something foul. Finally, he just shakes his head. "No can do, buddy," he says slowly. "The place is off limits. I'm not even supposed to go all the way to campus."
"Yeah, but..."
"No," he says again. This time, there's no room for argument. I squint my eyes and try to see as far down the street that dead ends into campus as I can, but all I can make out is a handful of big black SUVs and a couple of moving figures dressed in dark clothes. Todd clears his throat, and I snap back to the present.
"It's cool," I say.
"I just thought I'd ask." I force a grin. But if something happens to my jacket, I'm going to haunt you for the rest of your life. Todd gives a little smile as I back up and head away from the school. They won't even let him all the way up to campus, I think. What the hell are they doing there? Chapter 4. My grandmother's house is an older home in the country, 2 stories tall and filled with so much wood paneling that it feels kind of like a cabin on the inside. It's where my parents and I are staying for the time being, since our house is basically a pile of ash. My parents were going to start looking at building something new when everything in town went crazy, so now we're camping out with Nana, my dad's mom, indefinitely. I'm hardly out of my truck before Abby, our golden retriever, is on her hind legs and trying to lick my face. Dozer, our bulldog, stands up on the porch and looks for a moment like he's going to come greet me too before he just falls back down and starts to snore. Inside, the house smells delicious, like pot roast and mashed potatoes. It's my dad's favorite, which means he's probably in a bad mood today and Nana is trying to snap him out of it. My guess is justified because when my grandmother peeks around the corner from the kitchen, she tells me Mom's staying in Cleveland for another few weeks visiting her family, which, knowing my mom, is code for, I'm going crazy in this house with my mother-in-law. She's been acting kind of weird and distant since the whole house fire thing. But I keep telling myself things will be fine, and she'll come back to paradise once everything's blown over. Dad gets home not much later than I do. I guess that's one of the perks of being cut out of a big investigation. You get to have dinner on time every night. He tosses his dark sheriff's hat on a table near the front door and heads to the guest room he's staying in upstairs. Soon he's back down in a sweatshirt and jeans, and the three of us sit down for dinner at Nana's ancient, round dining room table that must weigh 2 tons. Nana says grace and asks us about our days. I give a vague answer about school going well. As far as my family knows, there's no difference in who I was at Paradise and who I am at Helena. My dad asks a few questions about whether or not the administration has decided if Paradise will have a baseball team this spring, or if we'll get merged with our new school, which would be worse than having no baseball at all. I shrug and dig into my dinner. Eventually, I get to prodding about the investigation. I saw Todd today, I say between bites of meat. He told me they're not even letting him up to the campus, even though he's supposed to be protecting the site. Officer Charleston, Dad says, chewing through Todd's last name, is not supposed to be gossiping about police affairs, and certainly not about any ongoing investigations. It was my fault. I stopped by when I saw he was manning the roadblock, forced him into talking to me. Don't worry, he wouldn't let me step so much as a foot past him. Dad doesn't say anything, just keeps on chewing with his eyes on his plate. I clear my throat a little and keep talking. So, have you been over to the school? What do they got going on over there? Any ideas about who or what was behind everything? The Smith kid and his father were behind it, Dad says, parroting the same thing everyone else has been saying. I want to correct him and tell him that Henri wasn't actually John's father, that he was some kind of guardian who protected me and Sarah and the others, who died doing so, and that I watched his body burn in a ceremony behind a slummy motel close by. But as far as Dad knows, John Smith was just a quiet guy in some of my classes, and I was nowhere near Paradise High the night everything went down. So instead, I just ask, how can they be sure it was him, though? They're sure. Dad's voice is gruff, meaning he's done talking about the subject. Who wants more rolls? Nana asks. Yeah, but what proof do they have? I ask, feeling a little bad for ignoring my grandmother. They must have something on him if they keep telling everyone he did it. Dad drops his fork down on his plate and looks across the table at me. Do you know who the they is you keep mentioning, Mark? Sort of. The FBI, for one. And you've probably seen enough movies to know how the FBI works and what happens to people who ask questions about top-secret investigations, right? Sure, I say. Black bags over your head and stuff? I don't know about that, but the last thing I want is for my son to end up in trouble because he was poking around in things he should have let be. It's bad enough that Sarah was involved with this boy. The last thing I want is for you to get wrapped up in it, too.
Of course, I say. He picks up his fork and keeps eating, but my head spins. Sarah was involved with this boy. It's not the fact that this is true that makes my stomach drop. It's that my dad knows. I rack my brain, trying to think of a moment I might have mentioned that Sarah and John were dating before or even after everything happened, but I can't think of one. Talking about a guy who kicked my ass and stole my girl is not exactly the type of thing I would bring up with my family. If Dad knows Sarah was involved with John, it's from the investigation, meaning the FBI and whoever else is in Paradise right now must know too.
You got another letter from Ohio State today,
Nana says as she tries to force a second round of mashed potatoes on me. The nice thing about living in a small town is that if your house burns down, the mailman can probably still find you. I'll look at it later.
Just like the letters from other colleges you said you'd take care of, right?
Dad asks.
The ones that have piled up on your desk? I went and looked at them earlier, and half of them haven't even been opened yet.
It's just, I start, but he won't have it.
Jesus, Mark! Do you have any idea how lucky you are? Do you have any idea how many other kids would kill to have schools clawing at each other to have you attend? To have even half of the scholarship money some of these places are offering you just to do what you love? To play football? How ungrateful.
He keeps going, but I zone out a little bit. When I think back on how hard and boring I thought the application process was for colleges, I feel like an idiot. But it was the most important thing in my life at the time, trying to remember whether or not I'd sent off all the right transcripts and letters of recommendation. Now, I realize there are much, much bigger things to worry about. Dad keeps lecturing me. He's normally a really nice guy, good to us, always there when I need him. The one thing he doesn't like, though, is when he feels useless. When things get taken out of his hands or jurisdiction, and he gets cut out of the loop. Then he gets cranky and starts to become a real dick at home. I guess that's something I must have inherited from him. Chapter 5. Alex Davis texts me after dinner. He's a wide receiver a year younger than me who was part of my close circle at Paradise High. Apparently, his parents are out of town for the weekend and he's managed to score a whole keg. Everyone we know is going over there. No open flames, LOL, he says. I text Sarah to ask if she wants to go, but she says no, as I expected. Inviting her is just a gesture. Neither of us is really in the mood to party lately. Pick any Friday night in the years before Moogs invaded Paradise, and I would have been out with friends, maybe out with Sarah, partying at someone's house or in a clearing in the woods that we'd circled our cars around. But now, I just don't see the point. There's an alien war that could break out here at any moment. When that happens, I don't want to be trying to recover from my third keg stand. My friends, my teammates, bothered me about my newfound lack of social life a lot at first. Then I told Sarah's friend Emily that I was weirded out about parties ever since my house burned down. That's not actually true, but Emily's kind of a gossip, and pretty soon no one was giving me shit about staying home so much, or at least most people weren't. I text Alex and say I'll pass, and he calls me a little bitch, and for half a minute I think that maybe I'll go over there to kick his ass and remind him which one of us was MVP, but then I just click my phone to silent and head upstairs. My room at the house used to be my granddad's office before he died. At least, everyone called it his office. Really, it was just the spare room where my grandmother stored all his old history books and Navy trunk and stuff like that. But there's a desk and a fold-out couch in there, which is all I really need. The first thing I do when I sit at the desk is log on to this blog I've started following called Aliens Anonymous. I stumbled on it by chance back in the first few days after the battle at the high school, and despite its dumb name, it's turned out to be pretty interesting. One of the guys running it, a dude who goes by the name Guard, posted a story from the local paper and wrote a bunch of stuff about how the whole destruction at the high school might be a cover-up for alien activity. At first, I thought Guard might have been from around here, but the Paradise incident was actually just one of many accidents or events he'd pegged as being somehow linked to aliens. In this case, at least, he guessed correctly. He'd even made the connection that the John Smith that everyone kept pinning stuff on was probably not exactly of this world. Searching through the blog's archives, I'd come across a few stories that sounded like they might have had to do with the Lorik or Moogs. The site is mostly a lot of posts that look like they belong in one of those Elvis Still Lives magazines at the grocery store, but some of them sound true, or at least like they could be true given what I've seen. I knew I could help the blog by telling them some of what I know, and by doing that, I could get them to help me search for clues as to where John and Sam and Invisible Girl might be now. So, after browsing the blog for a while, I'd contacted Guard and told him I was from Paradise and that I thought he might be right. There were a couple of weird emails from him, full of instructions that had made me wonder if I was dealing with some kind of messed up lunatic wearing a tinfoil hat, a guide on how to hide my IP address, passwords to access restricted sections of the blog, rules on when and how I could contact him. But after a while, we started to get to know one another. I guess I started to trust him, because before long, I'd told him about what happened at the school that night. Guard doesn't know everything, though. I've seen enough specials on the news to realize that I should question the identity of anyone I meet on the internet, especially now that I know the Moogs would do anything to find John and the others. I didn't tell him my name or anything, just that I saw things that made me a true believer. On the blog, I go by the name Jolly Roger 182, which I stole from the skull and crossbones flags flown at the Paradise Pirates football games and some of my granddad's old Navy stuff that's framed in the upstairs room. He was part of the fighting 182nd in the Navy. I wonder what he'd say if I told him I was gearing up to maybe have to one day fight for Earth. There are a couple of other people who are regulars on the blog, or editors, as we call ourselves. Usually it takes a long time to earn that title, but I must have really convinced Guard that I was legit because he gave me full access to the blog pretty fast. The others are fine and all, but Guard is the de facto ringleader, and the dude who's the most serious about everything that's going on. I'm happy to see he's online. We start chatting immediately. Jolly Roger 182. What's up, man? Jolly Roger 182. Anything new tonight? Guard. Hey, JR. Still trying to make sense of that thing in TN. Guard is convinced that a freak storm in Tennessee was caused by one of the Lorik's powers, but we haven't been able to track down any evidence. The story came from a police officer who had too much whiskey one night and started yelling to everyone at a bar about how some magic kids with the power to control thunderstorms were tearing across the state, and somehow that made it into the local paper. I called to see if I could talk to the officer, pretending I was someone from the Paradise Police Department, but they told me the guy had been transferred to a different county, and they couldn't put me in touch with him. I have a sneaking suspicion that's the FBI's version of sending a dog to a nice farm upstate, which probably provides more evidence that it was John and the others than anything else. Jolly Roger 182. Want me to look into it some more? I can try to call around again. Guard. No, take a look at this. Sound familiar? He sends me a link to a post on an online journal. It belongs to some girl named Meredith down in Miami. It starts out really sad. Her parents think she's on drugs and have had her in and out of institutions, and I can't figure out why Guard is interested in it. Then, after a few paragraphs, I get to what he's talking about. The reason her parents think she's on drugs is because she says she watched some random dude on the streets of Miami use what she describes as mind powers to shove her boyfriend up against the wall of a coffee shop, keeping him pinned there a few feet off the ground. My chat window dings while I'm reading. Guard. What do you think? Telekinesis? Guard. Could this be your friend? The timestamp on the journal entry is yesterday, but she doesn't say when the coffee shop event happened. Guard. Emailed to find out more info, but she hasn't gotten back to me. Jolly Roger 182. Hold on. Luckily, this girl's listed the facility her parents had her checked into and her full name. Not exactly smart stuff to put on the internet, but great for me. I look up the hospital and call the front desk. "Hi," I say when a woman picks up. "I'm trying to get in contact with Meredith Harris."
"Just 1 minute," the woman says.
I can hear the clacking of keys in the background for a few moments before her voice comes back again.
"Oh, I'm sorry, sir, but Ms. Harris was checked out a few days ago."
"Oh, I say, trying to come up with my next question. I realize that I probably should have thought this through more before I called, but thinking before I act isn't really my style. I go off instinct.
That can't be right,"
I continue. On my computer screen, I see the date of the journal post and something clicks in my head. It'll be easier to figure out if it was John in Miami if I know when this chick first got sent to the hospital.
"Maybe I have the wrong number. When was your Meredith Harris checked in?"
"Well," the woman says, I can tell she's hesitant to give me any more info.
"Please, ma'am. This is my sister. I'm just trying to make sure I know where she's at."
I must have come up with the right amount of sob story because she gives me a date. One that puts Meredith Harris going into the hospital at the same time I was trying to kick John's ass on the hayride. I thank the woman on the other end of the line and hang up, then turn back to guard. Jolly Roger 182. "No dice. I called the hospital. The girl was admitted while John Smith was here." Guard. "Maybe the actual incident occurred before he came to Paradise?"
Jolly Roger 182. "I don't think his powers came until he was here.
At least, that's what John told Sarah." In all our conversations about the Lorik and the Moogs, I've gotten to know basically everything he ever told her about himself. Guard. "Ah, okay. Maybe it's another Lorik, then." Jolly Roger 182. "Must be a dumb one begging to become Moog food." Guard. "So much stuff happening these days. A lot of weird activity." Guard. "I get the feeling everything must be coming to a head sometime soon. Don't you?" I hate that I agree with him. I poke around online a little more before calling it a night. My eyes strained too much and a headache coming on. I lie in bed and think of the same scene that's been replayed in my head a million times since everything went crazy. It's not even one of the weirder moments, like when a damned lizard monster attacked us or John's dog turned into some kind of dragon, or when alien bad guys turned into ash after being stabbed. It was when I was at John's house. It was when I'd found out the aliens existed. I'd gone over to John's house to ask about the video. That stupid video someone had shot on their phone of John flying like Superman out of my burning house, Sarah and the dogs with him. I'd ended up in the middle of a fight between him and the guy I'd thought was his father, Henri. And then weird stuff started happening. Henri stopped moving like he was frozen in place, which I now realize meant that John was using his telekinesis. They were talking about Sarah being in trouble, and then John was just gone. Running, I guess, all the way to the school. After he'd left, Henri was able to move again. I'd been furious that no one was answering my questions, but I couldn't help but feel bad for the guy. He looked like he was about to break in every way possible. I'd kept asking questions, but he kept ignoring me. He ran into another room. When he came back out, he was carrying a shotgun and this locked box with all kinds of weird symbols carved into it. I could tell he was on some kind of mission as he headed to his truck. I was fast, though, and got there before him, planting myself in the passenger seat. I needed to know what was going on, especially if Sarah was involved.
"I don't have time to deal with you,"
Henri had said as he jumped into the truck.
"Out!"
What was I supposed to do? How was I supposed to react to that? "If Sarah's in danger, you take me to her," I said, "no matter what." And I meant it. Suddenly, that was the only thing that mattered. Henri had looked at me long and hard before starting his truck. As we peeled out of his driveway, he shoved the locked chest into my lap. "What's this?" I asked. Henri just shook his head.
"Boy, you've got a lot to learn in the next 5 minutes."
Then everything went to hell. Lying on my pullout bed at Nana's, I think about this interaction, wondering why I got in the truck in the first place. I don't know, really. Looking back on it, I should have called my dad. or let Henri go alone. Or any number of options that wouldn't have put me at Moog Ground Zero. But something had told me to go with him. I'm glad I did. I mean, I saved John that night, and probably Sarah, too. But a little part of me wishes that I'd never gotten into that truck. That Henri hadn't told me about the war we were driving towards. A battle on Earth between two alien races. Part of me wishes I'd just walked away. Life would have been a lot less complicated that way. Chapter 6. The next morning, I realize I need to tell Sarah that the FBI and the police know about her and John. We'd assumed they had, but every concrete piece of information we can find helps us build a clearer picture of what's going on. Plus, I want to tell her about the stuff I've been researching with Guard. I've only ever talked about Aliens Anonymous in an abstract way, mentioning articles I found online, but not explaining that I'm now part of a super nerdy alien conspiracy blog. Maybe today's the day to tell her. She agrees to meet me for lunch, and by the time I get to the pizza place on the downtown square, she's already there. "Hey," I say as I slide into a booth opposite her. She looks at me with concern, her eyes darting around nervously. I'm confused. "If you don't want pizza, we can go someplace else." "No," she says, forcing a smile. "I'm just having kind of a weird day."
"How so?"
"Is there a woman with red hair in a black suit behind me?" Sarah whispers. I scrunch my eyebrows together in confusion and then look over her shoulder. Sure enough, there's a red-haired woman in dark clothes drinking a coffee alone and reading from an electronic tablet a few tables behind us.
"Yeah? Why?"
Sarah exhales a long, steady breath, shaking her head.
"We went out for dinner last night and she was there. This morning I went on a run and she drove by me four times. Now she's here."
"Shit," I murmur. "Well, there goes what I had to tell you."
"What do you mean?"
She sits up straighter, concerned. "Just that my dad mentioned the FBI knew you were connected to John in some way. I didn't figure they'd have you followed."
"Crap," she says.
We sit without saying anything for a few moments, trying to figure out what to do next. The silence is finally broken when the waitress comes by to take our order.
"Hey, Mark," she says sweetly.
I've eaten enough pizza here in my lifetime to receive Hall of Fame status. She knows me well.
"What can I get you?"
"Hey, we'll take a medium, half-meaty, half-veggie. Mine and Sarah's old standby order. I'll have a soda." The waitress smiles at me and then turns to Sarah. She sneers in a way that makes it obvious she wants Sarah to notice.
"You want anything?"
she asks, an edge to her voice. This is Sarah's life now, the Mad Bomber's girlfriend. I want to cause a scene but swallow down the urge because apparently we're already getting enough attention as it is. Sarah turns her head and locks eyes with the waitress, giving her a look that I recognize. I've been on the receiving end of it too many times, the kind of glare that makes you think your face is going to melt off.
"Diet soda, ma'am," she says, emphasizing the last word.
The waitress rolls her eyes and walks away. Sarah just sighs. "Geez, some people," I say.
"It's not some people, it's all people. I mean, half the town thinks I'm some kind of terrorist floozy. Even if they don't say it, you should see the looks I get. And that's not counting the people who are following me."
"Okay, so what do we do now? Run away and try to find John and the others? I'll go with you if you do. Hell, I'll drive." I have no desire to go on a blind search for the Lorik, but if Sarah wants to go, I'm not letting her go alone. And I have to admit, the idea of a road trip with Sarah is appealing, even if it is to track down her alien boyfriend.
"How would we even find them?" she asks.
"Actually," I say, lowering my voice, "I've kind of been doing some research on the whole, well, you know, everything. There are people out there who know about this stuff. People like Sam, who the rest of us thought were just kind of crazy. I've been talking to some of them, and we think we might have figured out a little more about what's going on.
What do you mean? Sarah says, perking up. What kind of stuff?
Well, now that I've seen John and Six in action, I kind of get what you'd need to look for. There was a girl in Miami who saw her boyfriend get picked up using telekinesis. It wasn't John, but it might have been one of the others like him. Maybe someone who's in contact with John. And one of the other bloggers has been keeping track of this guy in India, who some of the locals have been worshipping as a god.
Yeah, but how do you know these bloggers or the people they're writing about aren't just a bunch of crazy people?
Well, a day or two after John and the others left Paradise, a police officer in Tennessee had pulled over some teenagers driving a suspicious car. But before he could arrest them, some kind of supernatural winds basically blew him out of the way. Sarah raises her eyebrows, a glint of hope in her eyes.
Sound familiar?
Six.
That's what I think. She grins, but it only lasts for a few seconds before the reality of the situation sets in.
They could be anywhere by now, she says.
Yeah.
So there's nowhere for us to even start our search.
We pause as the waitress comes back and sets down my drink in front of me, then half slams Sarah's onto the table, sending little drops of diet soda lapping over the rim of the glass. She leaves without saying a word.
We could go anyway, I suggest, trying not to sound enraptured by the idea of all that alone time with Sarah.
Skip this small town and let everything blow over.
She gives me a little smile and shakes her head.
My family, she says.
But I can tell I've overstepped my bounds in her mind, and I'm sounding too much like an ex-boyfriend who's trying to drop the ex part.
Plus, if John came back looking for me, he'd be heartbroken if I wasn't here.
He'd be an idiot if he came back to Paradise, I mutter. The words come out before I can stop them, so I try to explain.
I mean, with all the suits running around here.
As if she overheard this as her cue, the red-haired woman gets up and walks over. She slides into the booth beside Sarah. Before I can react, there's another dark-suited person sliding in beside me. A man who looks like he's in his late 20s with olive skin and close-cropped black hair. We're trapped in the booth.
What the?
I start.
You're Mark James, the red-haired woman says. The sheriff's son. And you're Sarah Hart. What do you?
Sarah says. My name is Agent Walker with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and this is my associate, Agent Noto. I hope you don't mind if we join you.
We do, I say, narrowing my eyes.
Agent Walker smiles. Noto hasn't said a word or done anything but stare back and forth between Sarah and me. I wonder how close he was to us. Did he hear me talking about the blog earlier? Does he know what we've been talking about?
We're just trying to get an idea of what happened with John Smith here in town. As you probably know, he's a person of high interest. There are several incredibly generous rewards that are being offered for any information on his whereabouts.
She turns her attention to me.
I was sorry to hear about what happened to your home, by the way, but I'm sure the reward money could go far in rebuilding.
Is this woman really trying to bribe me into telling her about John?
After all, I'm told the blaze started at a party you were throwing,
she continues. I'm sure you've been wondering how you can make things up to your parents after something like that. My mouth drops open a little, and I feel like I've been punched in the gut.
You've been watching me, Sarah says, changing the subject. I've seen you.
Of course you've seen me, the woman says. We wanted you to know that we're here, keeping the town safe.
You're following me,
Sarah says, gritting her teeth a little. I'm simply doing my job by ensuring that we follow up on every lead.
And you think Sarah is a lead? I ask.
We think you know more about John Smith than you might even realize.
Walker never takes her eyes off Sarah.
You were dating him. You must have some information that would be relevant to our investigation, something that might help us to decipher exactly what happened at your school.
I hardly knew him, Sarah says, staring down at the table.
We weren't dating.
We saw a video that looked like he was flying out of your burning house, the woman says to me. She turns back to Sarah.
He was carrying you. Sarah smiles. It's crazy what you can do with cameras in a few hours on the computer, isn't it? She asks.
Sam was always good at stuff like that when he had presentations at school, I add. He probably did it. Sarah kicks me under the table. I can't figure out why until the agent turns to me and smiles.
Samuel Good. His mother, Patricia Good, is a nurse. Father is Malcolm Good, She pauses for a moment before smiling a bit. Current whereabouts unknown. Sam hasn't been home since that night either. His mother is worried sick about him. It would be nice if she had any assurance that her son was alive.
Sam is... Sarah starts, but then stalls. I recognize the look on her face. She's trying to connect all the dots and carefully plotting out what she's going to say. Speaking carefully has never been my strong suit. Sam Good is a conspiracy theory nutjob, I say, lounging back in my booth a little. That little twerp wears the same NASA t-shirt every day of the week. You should hear the kinds of things he talks about. Aliens, the Illuminati. Personally, I think it's his way of trying to get people to notice him when all the attention goes to me and my buddies on the team. He probably finally had enough of it and ran away, using the school thing as an excuse. He's smart, but he's also a total wuss. Trust me when I say he can't handle himself in a fight, not exactly terrorist material. If you ask me, he's probably hunting for Sasquatches in the woods somewhere. That's where I'd try to find him, at least. I take a big swig of my soda and glance over at Sarah, who's looking at me with a mixture of disgust and confusion. I give her a little kick under the table, and she manages a smirk. I take a chance and lean forward, grabbing Sarah's hands in mine. They're soft and tremble slightly. I have to hold them still against her initial urge to pull away. Isn't that right, babe? I ask, flashing the toothiest grin I can muster her way.
That's probably true, she mutters. Well, that's very enlightening, Mr. James, Agent Walker says. I think I'm ready to go now, Sarah says, scooting towards Walker. The agent doesn't move. But you haven't even eaten yet, she says.
Agent Nodo still hasn't so much as breathed, as far as I can tell.
I'm not hungry, Sarah says. Why don't we talk a little more?
Oh, are you charging us with something? I ask.
What would we have to charge you with?
Walker says with a smile that's just a little too forced.
Nothing,
I shrug. I just know you can't keep us here unless you are actually going to arrest us or something. That's how my father's always said the law works. Walker gives a few short laughs, which seem to say, how very cute that you think that's how things work around here. Still, she slides out of the booth. Agent Nodo follows her.
If you happen to remember anything,
Walker says, pulling a business card from her suit pocket and holding it out to Sarah,
do let us know. We'll be in touch.
In a flash, Sarah's left the booth and headed for the door. It takes me a little longer to get out, and Walker's standing in my way when I stand.
That girl is trouble, she says, still holding up the card. Don't let her take you down with her.
We stare at each other for a moment. Her eyes are light and intense. Finally, I take the card and slip it into my pocket, then push past her. On the way out, our waitress rounds the corner with our steaming pizza.
Hey, where are you going?
She asks, clearly ticked off. I shrug and point to Agent Walker. Red's taking care of our lunch, I say, and then I'm gone. Chapter 7. Sarah's waiting for me on the sidewalk a few stores down. When I get close, she starts to walk away quickly, and I have to jog a few steps to catch up to her.
What was all that about? She asks.
You're going to have to be a little more specific, I say.
All that stuff about Sam, for starters.
I was just trying to cover my ass if they didn't already think he was with John after I stupidly said his name, trying to throw them off the trail.
Okay, then what about holding my hand? What was that?
I stop and turn to her. We're on the corner.
The wind whips her hair back and forth across her face, and she looks like tears might fall from her eyes at any moment. I have no doubt that the agents are still watching us, so I step to the side and make sure that they can't see her face from inside the pizza place. Sarah, if they think you're his girlfriend, they're going to keep watching you, I say softly. You know that. I was just trying to throw them off you as well. I can look out for myself, she says. I know you can, but you shouldn't have to. John shouldn't have... I know, she cuts me off in a huff. Trust me, I know. I'm well aware of how messed up this situation is, all of it. And if there was some way I could fix everything, I would. I half wish John would get arrested, because at least that way I'd know where he is and that he's safe. The wind whistles a little as we stand, not talking to one another. I want to hug her, to touch her in any way. And it takes a good amount of my willpower to remind myself that if I freak Sarah out, I lose the only person I care about and the only person I can talk to about everything that's happening. Other than a bunch of random people online who are probably old dudes living in their mom's basements and surviving on caffeine and corn chips. Besides, I've already pushed her as much as I can today.
Sam doesn't believe in Sasquatches,
Sarah finally says with a faint smile.
We talked about it before. No Bigfoot hunting for him.
At this point, I'm not sure that I don't believe in Bigfoot, I say. This gets a little laugh out of her, which makes me smile.
I don't know. I think I'd trust Sam on this one. He was way ahead of us in all this alien stuff. He probably knows more about John's history than John does.
This is true. It's something I file away for the future. What did Sam know? How did he find stuff out? And did he leave any records?
I've got to get out of here, Sarah continues.
Okay, where do you want to go? She shakes her head.
I just need to be alone for a little while,
she says, digging for her keys in her purse. Are you sure that's a good idea? I ask. I can come over if you want, or we can stay out in public where no one can get to you.
Thanks, but I'll be fine.
Besides, my brothers are home this weekend, and there's nothing they love more than trying to act tough and protect their little sister.
We'll talk later, all right?
Yeah, I say. I watch her walk away and make sure she gets to her car okay. She's just a speck down the road when my senses come to and I start putting things together about our weird encounter at the pizza place. Agent Noto was sitting behind me. Does that mean I'm being followed too? I walk around our tiny downtown for a little while, have to clear my head and have to keep an eye over my shoulder to see if I've got some kind of tail watching me while pretending to read a magazine or something. But there's no one. At least not anybody I can see. The card Agent Walker gave me gives me absolutely no info. It's blank other than a phone number, which goes straight to voicemail when I call it from the only payphone I know of in Paradise. I don't leave a message. Instead, I pull up the Aliens Anonymous blog on my phone and message Guard, telling him that I've had a really weird run-in with the FBI and that this is the contact number they gave me. Guard is good with computers and stuff, so maybe he can use it to find some new information or something. When I'm walking back to my truck, I run into Kevin, an offensive lineman from school. He's a giant of a guy, with patches of red hair all over his face that almost make it look like he's capable of growing an actual beard. Almost. A few of the younger members on the team are with him, but they hang back, letting him lead. I briefly wonder if that's what I looked like when I was always running around town with my own posse.
Dude, he says when he sees me. We do an elaborate series of handshakes and fist bumps. We were grabbing burgers and saw you talking with Sarah on the corner. Looked pretty intense. What's going on with you two? You hitting that now that Bomberman is gone?
Fire rages in me and I can feel my face turning red with anger.
Look, man, one of the younger guys says. He's blushing.
Don't talk about Sarah like that, I say. My jaw is clenched. The whole pack oohs as if they were a studio audience.
Sorry, man, I didn't realize you two were a thing again.
We're not, I say, trying to smile.
But I'm working on it. Must be hard being sloppy seconds to a terrorist, Kevin says with a smirk. Gotta make you wonder what she saw in a dude like him.
I move before I think. In a flash, I've got Kevin up against a brick wall, holding him by the arms of his letter jacket. He may be a giant, but I'm fast. And after years of strength training and weightlifting, I'm not exactly a lightweight. It feels like one of my veins is going to pop out of my head. It's been a while since I was in a fight. A real fight. Since the Moogs took over the school. And even then, I spent half the time hiding in a classroom with Sarah. Part of me wants to unleash on Kevin, just wail on him until I feel better about all the shit that's gone down. But I don't. He may be kind of a douchebag, but even if everything's changed for me, nothing is different for him. Kevin's expression morphs from surprise to fear to something else. Something friendlier. Something like recognition. "Check it out, you guys!" he says, turning his head to the others who are waiting for his instructions. "Mark James is back!" My pulse slows a little, and I suddenly start to feel a little high. I smirk. "John Smith had my sloppy seconds," I say. "I'm just reclaiming what was mine to begin with." The guys laugh and jeer at me. Someone yells, "It's Mark James, bitch!" a little too loudly, and we get disapproving looks from other people on the street. "We're heading back over to Alex's to try and finish off what's left of his keg before it goes flat. You coming or what?" Kevin asks. "Yeah, man," I say, not even thinking about it. It feels surprisingly good just to be standing around being bros again. Then I feel a buzz in my pocket. "In a little bit," I say. "Tell Alex I'll be over later." "Right on," Kevin says. And after another elaborate series of high fives and shakes, they're gone. I pull my phone out. There's a message from Guard. "Have you ever heard of an Agent Purdy?" Chapter 8. I spend the rest of the afternoon at home on the computer talking to the blog editors. Saturday afternoons must be a lazy day for conspiracy theorists because Guard and this other editor named Flyboy are both online and wanting to talk. Flyboy seems cool, but is much more of a skeptic about the stuff that Guard and I talk about. Which is good, I guess. Sometimes I think we need a rational person to keep us from totally going off the deep end. It turns out that Guard called the number Agent Walker gave me and got the same voicemail but didn't leave a message. A few minutes later, his phone rang, even though he'd purposefully blocked his number. Guard answered because he's not the type of dude to let a chance like that go by. The person on the other end of the line kept asking him how he got the number, but Guard played it cool and kept saying he knew what was going on in Paradise and demanded to talk to someone in charge. Finally, he got on the line with an FBI guy named Purdy. According to Guard, Purdy was a huge hard-ass who sounded really annoyed and anxious to get off the phone until Guard said he knew about the Moogs. This, apparently, got Purdy's attention. Only then Guard didn't want to talk anymore, and Purdy wasn't giving him any info about what the FBI knew or didn't know. Flyboy says this doesn't mean anything, but I think otherwise. If this Purdy guy works for the FBI and recognized what Guard was talking about, it proves that the FBI here knows what's really going on. The only question then is how much they know and who they're trying to help. We chat online for a few hours as we try to dig up anything we can on Purdy, but all we find is a picture of a piggish-looking man standing in the background at some government ceremony. It's not much to go on. Not anything to go on. My phone buzzes constantly with messages from my teammates over at Alex's. There are more and more typos in them as the hours wear on. Finally, I give in and head over once my brain is so full of government conspiracies and half-formed conclusions that I feel like it might just leak out of my ears. When I tell my dad I'm headed to Alex's to hang out with the guys, he gets a wide grin on his face. "Good to see you getting out of the house and being a high schooler again," he says. "I thought you were turning into some kind of loner." I shrug and force a laugh, then head out before the conversation gets any deeper than that. I'm almost out the door when he yells to me, "My truck's parked behind yours. Just take mine if you don't mind." He tosses me his keys. "Sure," I say. Dad's truck, the thing he likes to drive when he's off duty and wants to get away from the police cruiser, is a small single cab. Kind of a piece of crap, but I'm not going far. I keep an eye out for any cars following me, but I don't see anyone. Plus, it's all back roads from my grandmother's place to Alex's, which is about as clandestine as you can be in paradise. I think about calling Sarah and seeing if she wants to come, but I know she'll say no. Especially since the FBI's got eyes on her. Would the FBI bother with busting a bunch of underage drinkers? Besides, I know the guys well enough to guess that they'll start talking about either me and her or her and John, and the last thing she needs is to be harassed by a bunch of drunk football players. As expected, everyone at Alex's is pretty buzzed. Half the team is there, and for a while it feels like it could be any Saturday night out of the last few years. Still, I spend the few hours I'm there sipping on the same warm beer just in case I need to keep my wits about me. No one seems to notice that I never need a refill as long as I've got a red plastic cup in my hands and mime drinking every so often. When it starts to get a little late, I sneak out the back into my dad's truck. I don't bother saying goodbye to anyone. Tomorrow morning, no one will remember what time I left, and I'll get a text or two talking about hangovers and asking if I got home okay. I'm about to start the truck when I realize there are extra keys on Dad's ring. One for our old house, one for my grandmother's, and a few more with rubber around the tops. The keys to the police station. The hair on the back of my neck stands on end as I consider the possibilities of what this could mean. From what my dad's told me, the FBI is basically working on site at the school. That means, at this time of night, there are only a couple of officers at the station, maybe a few agents too. But I know my way around pretty well up there. If I were to drop by, I could probably figure out a way to sneak past the front desk and get into my dad's office, where all kinds of files might be kept. Even if the FBI is taken over, there must still be initial reports at the station. Whatever it was that my dad and his officers saw when they arrived on scene that night. If I could get my hands on some of those, maybe they could shed more light on the investigation. I drive towards the police station before I can talk myself out of it. Chapter 9. Todd's the only officer on duty. I think I'm the luckiest guy alive until he rolls his eyes and gives me a long, drawn-out sigh as I walk in. "Go home, Mark," he says curtly. "Todd, man, what are you doing here all alone?" "Someone mentioned that I was talking to civilians while on duty yesterday and I got switched to the graveyard shift. That's what." "Oh," I say. "Oops." "Plus, there's been some kind of electrical fire on the outskirts of town that everyone was raring to get to." He inhales and wrinkles his nose a bit. "Jesus, you smell like a bar." I'm not exactly surprised. Alex's house smelled like it had been sprayed down with cheap beer. Still, this electrical fire is great news for me. "I was just at a party," I say with a shrug. "Someone must have spilled something on me. You know how it is. You've told me about the epic ragers you guys used to throw when you were on the team." Todd gets a wide grin and goes into a story I've heard 100 times from him about how he drank the entire special team's roster under the table out in the woods on his 18th birthday. I smile and nod and tell myself that I'm never going to be this dude when I get older. If humans aren't the alien workforce or something by then. Finally, he's done. "Man, that sounds so hardcore," I say, forcing a grin. "I'm super jealous. Anyway, I just came by to pick up some stuff my dad left for me in his office." Todd nods and gestures to my dad's door, still grinning from his memories. I unlock the office with Dad's keys and quietly close the door behind me. The place is a mess of files strewn about the desk and seemingly random sheets of paper stacked on every surface. I start digging through the piles, but after a few minutes of searching, all I come up with are weeks-old traffic violations and endless paperwork on stuff not at all related to John or the Moogs. Then I realize that, of course, that stuff's not going to be lying around, and I use one of the small keys on the key ring to open the filing cabinet by my dad's desk. After flipping through a few hanging folders, I come to the one I'm looking for. Paradise High School. Yes. The first file I pull out is full of initial accident reports and non-disclosure agreements from the first responders. I toss it on the desk to come back to later. The second file's a jackpot. Full-page photos of the destruction at the school. The trenches dug through the football field and the huge divots I recognize as actually being footprints. Shotgun shells littering a classroom we hold up in for a while. The trashed auditorium. All signs that point to the fact that this was maybe something other than the work of a teenager with a vendetta against the school. My pulse pounds as I take out my phone and start to snap photos of the pictures. I can upload them all to the blog later. Guard and the others will flip when they see this shit. I rifle through the pictures as fast as I can, recording each one. My brain is buzzing and I can hear my blood thumping in my ears. Maybe that's why I don't hear anyone come in. Someone yanks the back collar of my shirt and jacket, choking me. I'm swung around and the surprise causes me to drop my phone. The file photos scatter across the floor. I expect to be staring into the face of a Mogadorian or one of the agents. But it's worse. It's my father.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
He bellows. Dad, I was...
Do you have any idea how much trouble you'd be in if someone else caught you in here? How much trouble I'd be in?
Dad, let me...
This is a matter of national security, Mark! I mean, Christ!
He pushes me backwards with a strong shove. I stumble over my feet and hit the ground hard as Dad's picking up my phone. He taps on it, systematically deleting everything I've taken pictures of, cursing the entire time. It's only then that I realize how weird it is that he's here in full uniform so late. Whatever happened with the fire tonight, it must have been important enough to call him in. When he's done deleting things, he just stands there staring down at me for a minute.
Go home, Mark,
he says, emphasizing every syllable he can.
And stay there.
He starts to hand my phone to me when my text message sound goes off twice, so instead he turns the screen to see what's on it. That's when his face goes white. What? I ask. He doesn't respond, only reaches down and pulls me up to my feet, half dragging me out of the office.
Todd!
He barks, and then Todd is standing by the front door.
Outside, now!
Dad, what's going on? He's still pulling me behind him. I could fight back, but I can tell he's furious. Something's wrong. Something bad has happened. When we get to Todd's police car, Dad pulls open the back driver's side door and shoves me inside. I manage to rip my phone out of his hands as I go in, and Dad slams the door before he realizes I've taken it. He yells at Todd,
"You take him straight back to my mother's house. If he puts up any fight, arrest him."
Todd looks at me, shaking his head, as my dad runs to his patrol car, yelling something into his radio. It's only then that I look down at my phone. There are two texts from Sarah. OMG, John is here. Don't come, but if something weird happens, I'll text you.
Shit.
My mind starts to race as I figure out what to do next. I call Sarah immediately. When she doesn't answer, I text.
Dad saw this. He's coming for John. Get out.
And then I realize what this means. Dad's calling in the FBI, the police, hell, the fire department. Everyone's about to converge on Sarah's house, and she doesn't know. She's probably making out with a fucking alien, and the FBI and weirdo Agent Walker are going to find her. I start banging my fist against the metal separating the front and back seats in Todd's car, shouting as he gets in.
No! We have to go to her! Todd, man, take me to Sarah's! You have to take me to Sarah's right now! Go, go, go!
The only place I'm taking you is home. I keep beating on the metal until blood starts to trickle from my knuckles, and Todd slams his own fist against the grate, yelling at me to shut up, then muttering profanities to himself. I'm frantically texting Sarah, and he says, "And I thought the explosion at the goods place was going to be the highlight of the night." The goods place. Explosion. My head tries to put everything together, ignoring the pain in my hand and the blood beating in my brain. John's here. He's in paradise, probably with Sam and Six. There was an explosion at Sam's house. All the cops were called out to it. If there was an explosion, that must mean there was fighting. And the only people John would be fighting The Moogs. The Moogs are here. They're after John. And John's with Sarah. Chapter 10. I stay home for the rest of the night. I don't really have a choice. Nana sits in a chair at the bottom of the stairs with one eye on my door and another on my truck outside. Dad's personal sentry. I have no doubt that if I take one step outside the house, there'll be an officer ready to pick me up before I even make it to the street. The last thing I need is to get thrown into a holding cell, even though it's possible that would actually put me closer to Sarah. Sarah. She's all I can think about. In the upstairs office, I drive myself crazy, pacing back and forth, hoping that she's all right, and that if things got bad, John at least was able to keep her safe. As much as I hate it, I have to believe that no matter what, he'd protect her. I text Guard and tell him that shit's going down in paradise, but he doesn't text me back. Of course, this is the one night he's not glued to one of his screens. I text Dad about 1,000 times, at first apologizing and then asking what's happened. He doesn't respond until finally I ask him just to tell me that Sarah is okay, and he replies with a single, magic word. Yes. At least there's that. As I pace, I listen to my dad's old police scanner, which I grabbed from his room. There's so much yelling and chatter that I can barely make anything out. There's something about a suspect being in custody, then a lot of static. I hear Sarah's name and someone mention the Paradise Station. And then someone says something about a Dumont facility. After that, all the messages stop. Radio silence. Someone must have realized that the police radios weren't secure enough. I imagine Agent Walker pulling a giant plug that disables the entire radio system, even though I know that's not how any of this actually works. An internet search of Dumont Facility FBI brings up some articles about some huge, strictly off-limits FBI compound in Dumont, Ohio, about 2 hours away. If Sarah has been taken in, I have to believe that she is being detained in the station jail and not being shipped out to some secret FBI prison. And so at dawn, I take a chance and head downstairs and out into the front yard. Nana's no longer at her post, so I guess her orders were just to make sure I stayed in through the night. I jump in my truck and head into town. Dad's phone going straight to voicemail by now. I park across from the station, watching, trying to get a look at Sarah or anyone else coming in or out. Every time the front door swings open, my chest pounds, only to be disappointed when someone other than Sarah walks out. Each time this happens, I get a little more worried. It's a little past 8 a.m. when Sarah comes outside, and I feel so supercharged with happiness and relief. She's still here. They've let her go. Maybe this will end up all right after all. Sarah looks a little scared, and it's my first instinct to jump out and sprint straight to her. Instead, I drive along beside her as she walks down the street. Sarah, I say, as I pull up to the curb. The whites of her eyes are red, like she's been crying recently. Get in. My parents are coming, she says. They came to the station when they realized I wasn't at home and stuff was going crazy outside, but the agents at the front desk made them go back home, threatened to have them arrested if they stayed around asking questions about what happened. I told them to pick me up at the grocery store down the street so they wouldn't have to come back in. They're going to have so many questions. Tell them I'm taking you home. My cell phone's gone. You can use mine, I say, leaning over and opening the passenger side door. After a short phone call, lots of, I'll explain in 5 minutes when I'm home, she hands me back my phone and lowers her head into her hands. What are you going to tell them? I ask. I don't know. I'll figure something out. Maybe I can tell them I need some sleep before we talk. Are you okay?
No,
she says through her fingers.
John came back. I got super emotional and weird with him because I was feeling so crappy about everything before he just magically showed up, and then the FBI tackled me. I don't know where John is now, and I am officially pegged as a person who is somehow connected to all this. I've been sitting in an interrogation room for the last 3 hours.
What'd you tell them?
Nothing, she says. It was that Walker agent and a few other people. Noto, and some guy named Purdy.
I note the name. The agent Guard talked to on the phone. Is he the one in charge of everything going on in town? Sarah continues. They wanted to know why John came to see me, and I told them it was because we made out a few times before he went crazy, and he probably thought that I'd do it again if he showed up and threw pebbles at my window like we were in some kind of rom-com. I just pretended to be dumb. And they believed that? No, I don't think so, but they let me go at least. They have John. I think that's all they really cared about. They just told me to make sure I didn't leave town or there'd be trouble. She shakes her head. I'm on a freaking no-fly list, they said, as if I'd try to skip the country or something. Shit. I know. Sarah pulls the edge of her gray sweater over her fingertips. I feel so stupid. This is my fault. No, it's mine. My dad saw the text you sent. I shouldn't have let that happen. She looked surprised about this for a second, even happy that what happened last night might not have been her fault. Then her face falls. They were probably watching me anyway. I should have told him, but instead I just ran outside. I was so happy to see him. You don't know that they had eyes on you. I don't know what they've done with him, she says. Her voice is about to crack. John. I think he's in Dumont. There's some kind of FBI facility near the state border. What? She practically shouts, jumping in her seat and straining against the seatbelt. We have to go. I have to talk to him. I have to explain to him that I didn't... No way, Sarah. You were just held and interrogated for being caught with him. You may not realize this now, but they could have arrested you for helping a criminal. The dude is on the most wanted list, Sarah. I'm not taking you to an FBI prison so you can get yourself in more trouble. It's not what he would want. The words come spilling out of me. Suddenly, I'm hearing John's voice in my head. That I have to make sure she's kept safe. And right now, that means keeping her as far away from the Lorik and the Moogs as I can. Besides, I say, softening up a little, he has superpowers. Do you really think he's going to stay locked up for long? I guess you're right. Sam was with him, but Six wasn't. She'll track them down if he's in trouble, I bet. I'm sure. She's one girl I'd hate to have mad at me. Sarah scowls a little, but I can't decipher what the expression means. I've got to buy a new phone, she says, or try to get mine back from the FBI. She gets quieter. Like that'll ever happen. You should buy a burner phone.
A what?
You know, I say. Like they have in shows about drug dealers and stuff, a prepaid cell phone. You know the FBI's going to be tracking every text message and call you get on your old number.
God. Are we like drug dealers now?
She asks, staring out the window of my truck like I've watched her do 1,000 times.
How is this our lives?
Don't blame me, I say. Blame the impending war for our planet between the humanoid aliens and shark-faced bastards with magical swords. When I drop her off, her parents are waiting on the front porch. I watch as their expressions run the gamut from worried to relieved to furious, then some weird mixture of all of them. I stay in the truck, but her dad makes sure to shoot me a glare that tells me in no subtle way that he's blaming me for whatever happened to his daughter. After all, I'm the party-loving ex they had to pry her away from over the summer to begin with. My chest falls a little. Maybe dropping her off wasn't the best idea. Her cell phone's gone. If I'm lucky, she'll be able to keep her computer for study purposes, otherwise... There's no way the Harts are letting me see or talk to their daughter. It's late in the afternoon when I finally hear back from Dad, who's been at work since he caught me in his office. He calls while I'm deep into researching a series of crop circles a few counties west of us, though I'm pretty sure that they're just hoaxes and have nothing to do with actual aliens. Hi, I say when I answer the phone. I'm not sure whether to expect to be yelled at or apologized to. Probably the first one. Instead, I hear a long sigh on the other end of the line. Oh, thank God, Dad says. He sounds so relieved. What did he think had happened to me? What is it? I ask. Where are you? At home? Good. Have you talked to Sarah? Not since this morning. Listen. He pauses for a moment and then starts talking quieter. Stay where you are. You can't leave the house. I assume the agents took Sarah's phone away from her for evidence, but if you can, get her a message telling her to stay put, too. She's a good girl. I always liked her. She shouldn't be wrapped up in all this.
Dad, what's going on?
My imagination is suddenly going wild and picturing Mogadorian ships landing all over Paradise, though I have no idea what they would even look like. I can't really say, but something's happened that's causing the FBI to go crazy. It's possible there might be one or two people we recently detained who are now unaccounted for. Seems like some weird stuff is going on over in Dumont, where they were taken. I just want to make sure neither of you kids got any bright ideas of running away with your classmates if they wandered back through town.
John and Sam, they've escaped.
That didn't take long.
I'll stay here, Dad.
Even as I say my goodbyes, I'm on my computer emailing Sarah. Her response is an entire page of exclamation marks. Guard is the next person I contact. I've told him that one of my friends was brought in for questioning and that one of the Lorik has been taken into custody. He's happy to hear that John has escaped. Guard, awesome news. We need more good aliens out there. Jolly Roger 182. Deaf. Guard, I guess this means we know who the feds are working for. Jolly Roger 182. What do you mean? Guard, if the FBI was working with the Lorik, he wouldn't have had to escape, right?
I lean back in my chair. He's right.
Of course he's right. If the FBI took John into custody and interrogated Sarah after the fact, they definitely aren't working on our side.
Jolly Roger 182. Shit.
Guard. You said it was Agent Purdy who was in on the investigation? Jolly Roger 182. And some others, a woman named Walker, too.
Guard.
Sounds like it's time for me to amp up my investigation into Purdy.
Jolly Roger 182.
I thought you said you found everything you could.
Guard. There are other ways.